Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.
Hello, this is Tim Reedy sitting in for Father Matt Malone.
And I'm Kevin Clark. I guess I'm sitting in for Carrie Weber then.
Yes, you are.
This week. We're talking to Eileen Markey about her recent article for America Magazine, which you can find at americamagazine.org. Canadian Catholics grapple with a history of whitewashing Indigenous children. Really a shocking story out of the 19th and 20th century. What a century, huh? Boy, I'd like to redo the 20th sometime. It just did not work out well for the church or the world.
Well, now might be a good time to bring in our guest who's been sitting with us, Eileen Markey. Great to have you today.
Thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
So Eileen has an article, which I mentioned earlier, which is in a recent issue called Canadian Catholics Grapple with the History of Whitewashing Indigenous Children. And we were just talking about, Eileen, about, you know, what's been happening at our border with separating families. Unfortunately, this is not a new practice, and something you report about happened in the last century in Canada. Maybe you can introduce this story to our listeners.
Sure. This is a story about residential schools for Native Americans who in Canada are referred to as First Nations people. The Canadian government had a policy. It was understood by some as an education policy, but it was understood by the Canadian government and is now acknowledged as such as an eradication policy, a plan to eradicate the First Nations people in Canada. You know, a policy that developed over or was instituted for several hundred years. I wrote about a very recent part of that erasure, elimination policy, which was this residential boarding school system for First Nations kids. It operated from the 1930s until the 1970s in Canada. A identical system operated in the United States from the 1870s until about the 60s as well. I just happened to write about the version in Canada. And the reason I wrote about it in Canada is because, unlike the United States, the Canadian society has had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission around the treatment of its First Nations peoples through this residential system. There's a bunch of different angles to it, but the story I wrote was actually really a story about memory and reconciliation and facing culpability and facing participation with evil.
And the church's role in it, correct?
Right. So these residential schools were administered by religious organizations. So I was writing about the Sisters of Charity of Halifax, a religious order, right, of Catholic nuns who ran two of these schools. There were hundreds all across Canada, most of them run by Catholic orders, some of them run by Anglicans, some of them run by Methodists, you know, all the different Christian religions in Canada.
Is the church always a go-to person when governments are looking for, you know, education or social services? I mean, how did the church get drawn into this kind of work?
Canada has a really different relationship between church and state than the United States does.
Mm-hmm.
More like Ireland or France or a lot of European countries. So there was this policy anyway of taking Native kids away from the places where they lived, which are called reserves there, what we would call in the U.S. reservations, right? Taking children away from their families and sending them to boarding school, to residential boarding school. And I think the way that a lot of white people in Canada or us as non-Native people in the U.S. might think about it is like, right, well, because the reserves were terrible places, right? They were terrible, and you wanted to get kids out of that environment and educate them and bring them to the boarding school where things could be better. That's the memory that the Sisters of Charity had, and that
their
a lot of
institutional memory of their participation.
Their institutional memory of their participation, the institutional memory of white people in Canada was, right, well, we don't do things like that anymore, but that was because your reserves were bad. And First Nations people in Canada said, yeah, that's not how it was. We started telling you in 1879 that this was awful.
What was the treatment like of kids at these schools?
So people would be taken, children, you know, just like the pictures we've seen from the border in the past few days, right? Children taken out of their parents' arms and pushed onto buses, pushed onto trains, and sent to other parts of the country. And they were not allowed to speak their native language. They were beaten if they did. They were not allowed to use their native names. Sometimes the kids were called only by numbers. They were physically punished, and I don't mean in like an old school paddle way. I mean in a cutting with scalpels on your skin sort of way if you spoke your native language. Siblings were separated and not allowed to speak to each other. So if you're the little brother who's four and your 12-year-old sister's in the girls' dormitory and you sneak out in the night to try to see your big sister, you're beaten. Some of the instruments of torture included cattails, which are, you know, leather, multi-stringed things. So this isn't, again, I think sometimes we have this tendency to minimize harm that happened in the past, right? It's almost like a... Well, almost like an instinct, right?
The impulse is, well, it was different times and different methods. And you,
right.
But you have to find yourself wondering, at what time was this ever an okay method? I don't know, during the Inquisition, perhaps? I mean, where did this methodology emerge from?
Right. And so the article I wrote was about this one community of women religious, was one community of nuns facing the fact that their community was involved in this sickness. And really looking at it square in the face. And I think it's such a human instinct to, even as I'm telling this story, I'm imagining that most of the listeners are saying, oh, but my father had his knuckles wrapped in school,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Yeah.
And
the good sisters sometimes had to take extreme measures, but yeah.
Right, but this was a different thing, and it was a stated policy of the Canadian government to erase the children's culture in order to assimilate them into a Canadian-European system. And again, you hear yourself in your head saying, yeah, well, because if they're going to make successful people, they needed to, right? And so the whole process of working on the story and listening to the First Nations people who were survivors of these schools or whose families went to these schools and survived or didn't, and talking to the sisters and then speaking to theologians was in trying to figure out how you face culpability, how you face involvement in that without the like, oh, but it was different.
Right, right.
Because we have this such an instinct to minimize and to want to rush to the reconciliation, right? So as I started to say, Canada actually had a public Truth and Reconciliation Commission around all of this, similar to South Africa or Rwanda, right? And that involved there being a bunch of lawsuits and then a financial settlement. And then after the financial settlement, the real work began, which was... hey, you know, non-Indigenous Canadians, you have to hear this.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to hold a bunch of public hearings all across the country.
Was it a 5 or 6 year process, I think?
Yeah, exactly. And the settlement involved, I think, maybe 99 requirements from everything from, you know, changing how it's taught in the state curriculum to language accommodations, changed road signs, things like that. But one of the major ones was simply a public hearing in each major city. And so I spoke to these sisters who participated in those by going and listening. And you just have to listen. You just have to listen. And you can't say, like, oh, but we didn't know. Oh, but we were trying, you know.
Right.
It was just a matter of acknowledging it, which I think is which is really difficult for white people to do, right? Anytime we're heard anything, anytime we hear the, you know, we always have this, oh, but, well, but why was he out at night? Why did you send your kids to the bodega? Oh, but what? Right. If you're going to ever get to reconciliation, first there has to be a truth-telling and an establishing of facts. And then there has to be a sincere sorry, right? Mm-hmm. Like, just like when you and I go to confession, it doesn't work unless you're sorry. Right.
Do the members of this religious community in the article, your article, they were mostly a generation removed, talking about the institutional culpability and the institutional remorse. Are there any? I mean, some of the people who suffered in these residential schools are middle age now, or my age, I guess. Well, I'm middle aged. So let's just cop to that. Do we have any living members of the community who can, you know, verify and offer a personal demonstration of remorse and atonement for what happened? Or is that generation, the survivors of that generation, just completely in denial about what transpired?
So I think there are three sisters who were members of this particular community who still worked in the schools when the schools were still running. The schools...
So they ran through the 70s, right?
Yeah,
early 70s.
And the Sisters of Charity, the school they ran, closed in 67. Things got a lot better. in the late 1950s. They were still, you know, keeping these children from their families, but in terms of the physical abuse, things got better. But no, I was not able to speak to those women. They're very elderly and were not made available to me, but there have been some tiny bits of facing that. I think the sisters I spoke to who were more of the next generation, right, women in their 70s as opposed to in their 90s,
yeah,
or in their 60s maybe, talked about that it was really hard for the older sisters, right, to face this, to acknowledge it. And so what they're doing, this kind of current generation of sisters, is they're doing that work of acknowledging it themselves, right?
And it wasn't just hard because maybe some of them were actually in the schools, but also the whole identity of the order was tied into a certain narrative that they believed what they had done good for this community, and suddenly that was totally turned on its head.
Exactly, that like changing memory, right? If we're going to change the future, if we're going to build a just society or the kingdom of God in the future, we have to have accurate understanding of the current, right? The current time and of the past. And we all carry these memories of what we think the past was, these inherited memories of the past. And for many of us, these are not true. These things we think about are not true. And so we can't build something real if we've got this glossed over idea of the past. But it's really painful when it gets personal.
And for these religious orders, it's like their family. It's like this, as if their family was involved in this, because they have such deep ties to these communities. Think of probably what the Jesuits go through, thinking about people in their past who owned slaves, where there was a controversy at Georgetown last year, trying to come to grips with this. So this is an issue that's not going away.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So I think I'm very interested in writing about that, about the challenges of memory and the challenges of eliciting your memory. And as Catholics, I think we speak about reconciliation more, especially with Pope Francis, right, about mercy and wanting to free ourselves of guilt and the sort of way our culture talks about it. This was going back to a very old school way of thinking, actually, right? Like, the sin's not going to go away until you're sorry for it.
But yeah, you mentioned, you write in your piece that reconciliation is a very Christian word, and you can see kind of the confessional as a way of comparing this. But is there a way that's also unhelpful? Because it is, in our tradition, it is quick. You can go into confession, and if you say you're sorry, then it's done. But it doesn't, it
Some
seems like this
is... Some of us
are
in there longer than others,
actually. But so is there a way that kind of thinking could get in the way of the process by trying to make it move too fast?
What some of the theologians I spoke to said, and some of the other people in the piece as well, yes, that like if we have this sort of cheap transactional understanding of what happens in that sacrament, then maybe that would be unhelpful. But if we're really thinking about clearing blockages, clearing clutter, right, clearing things that separate you from God, then it makes more sense, and especially that part of it, the
sadism.
We're right, but like, you know, the true regret for the sin, right?
Yeah.
And when we talk about social sin and when we think about social relationships, we probably have more of a tendency to just want to, right, well, that was terrible, let's move on, right? Whereas when we're thinking about our personal, whatever we've done wrong that's led us into the confessional, we're probably, if we're grown-ups with a fully formed conscience, is willing to like linger on it a little bit.
Well, you have to make a good confession, right? When that means you have to say everything and say it out loud and acknowledge it. And these religious community members you spoke with, they're taking the time to say out loud what happened and what happened to these children, and who now are suffering, in many cases, severely broken adults who've had broken lives because of this childhood experience. So those things have to be given time to be spoken out and aired and suffered with, I guess. It's hair-raising reading. I'm sure if you delved into the Truth and Reconciliation documents, the stories there are just incredible.
Yeah, it's hair-raising, and then it's hair-raising to think, I wrote a book about a heroic nun. I find them amazing women. I really am quite happy when I'm in a circle with these great, well-educated, thoughtful, humble activist nuns. And so this doesn't come from, I don't harbor those stereotypical ideas about nuns with rulers. I actually think of them as these like really fantastic, brave spiritual guides. And so to do this story for me actually was partly facing this other history. And it was, you know, you talked about in the Paul McCartney and that little video, that sense of humility. So here the sisters, the current day sisters, are having to hold this deep humility of facing it. And yeah, my order did this. My order that I thought was brave, roll up your sleeves, girls, and went out to the frontier and tried to help people. I'm going to have to acknowledge that that's not what we were doing.
What have some of the sisters told you about what that's like?
That it was incredibly difficult, that it continues to be difficult, that it kind of moves in this circular way. Let me see, I spend enough time with nuns, I speak in a really woo-woo way. But that there's these, you know, the past isn't over, right? The past, it keeps moving around in a circle or in some sort of an oblong, and we keep repeating it. And so in acknowledging what they were part of or what their older sisters in the community were part of, it's not like you do that once, right? They have to keep doing it. You have to keep facing it. Not in a sadistic way, but until you can say that truly.
Been purged.
Yeah. And that the restoration needs to happen also through real acts, right? So that the you don't get to the closure for the crime or restoration by just saying, oh my God, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry.
Right.
But that you have to make real restitution. That's kind of what the theologians and people who are experts on peace and justice reconciliation efforts talked about, that you need to hear what happened, you need to acknowledge it, you need to recompense at some real expense, and then you need to build something new. And so the Sisters of Charity are involved in these recompense at real cost, right? Hiring Indigenous people on their faculty at their school. They have a center for First Nation students at the school. They've had these public art projects, support for friendship centers among the First Nations in their province. Things that actually are measurable and that count, you know?
Yeah.
Because on the other hand, right, that the sweeping under the rug is not right. But on the other hand, endlessly torturing oneself but not doing anything about it is also that also doesn't get you anywhere.
Eileen, you mentioned folks who want to find out more about this or who might be remembering their own suffering or experience in Canada or in the United States, because as you say, we had a similar program here in the United States. Where can we point them to find out more?
So the Canadian government sponsors something called Truth and Reconciliation Canada. Those are all proper nouns, you know.
And it's
all capitalized.
It's a giant website, right?
Right. There's this giant website called Truth and Reconciliation Canada, where you can read all of the like 99 points of agreement on what will happen afterwards. Like I was saying, changes in curriculum, acknowledgement, language rights, things like that. But also, many of these testimonies have been collected and are archived there. There's photographs. And timelines of this long process. This is a process that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission process has been happening in Canada for 15 years. And it began in the 1990s, really, when a man named Phil Fontaine in Western Canada, who had a position of authority among the Manitoba chiefs. He's a First Nations person who was involved in his, you know, his local administration, made allegations of sexual and physical abuse in one of these schools. And that sort of opened the floodgates for many, many other allegations of abuse from First Nations people against the church entities that ran these schools. And what was beginning to happen is that there were, just like we saw in the sex abuse crisis cover-up here in the U.S., all these different lawsuits that were threatening to bankrupt Catholic and Protestant churches in Canada. And then the churches turned to the government and were like, hey, but you know what? This was your policy, Canadian government. We were administering your schools for you. And so then there were countersuits. And basically Canada tried to do this big omnibus, let's settle all of these at once, put together a giant restitution fund, get all the legal stuff finished, which took a very long time, but set up a a monetary settlement fund administered by the nation. And then after that is the, okay, now that that's all finished and people got tens of thousands of dollars and, you know, there's like a whole calculus of what you were owed. And then after that comes this truth-telling part. What I say in the article is that, you know, there's the financial settlement and then there's the much harder work that has nothing to do with money, but everything to do with memory, and everything to do with acknowledging what happened. And really, it will take forever to get people to understand what we've done, right? What our ancestors have done, what we've benefited from, what we keep doing. And I know some people hear somebody speak that way and just kind of immediately turn off. But that doesn't make it not true. And it's really difficult to look at the past. But if we ever want the past to end, that needs to happen. And that's what the theologians and the spiritual people say. It's like, if you ever want the past to be over, you have to heal it. And then you can build something new beyond it. So I found it very difficult to write this story and very difficult to report it. Someday I'll write about something happy. But I found their great bravery and grace in the willingness of the sisters to look this awfulness square in the face and try to contemplate it. Because when you think about it, even more personal, right, individual bad things that happened in your family's history, they need to be confronted in order to end, right? Or the distortion just kind of continues and you continue on in a distorted way. Mm.
And you talk about how the past, the pain isn't confined to the past either. You don't have to be, or even people who weren't in the system are suffering the effects of it. Maybe their parents went through it and then had a broken life, like Kevin mentioned, with abuse or alcoholism. So what are some of the effects that are present?
A ton of, you know, family abandonment, right? Young adults came out of these schools. They were very bad at being schools.
Yeah,
first of all, they were very good at destroying kids.
They didn't do a good job
right,
teaching
they,
these kids
right.
either. Yeah.
They stripped people of their culture and their connection to family and you know, nation group, right? Ethnic group. But they didn't do a good job in teaching them English or math or social studies.
So the purported goal of assimilation was also deeply compromised, because how do you assimilate in a culture that's modern like Canada without skills, without a language skills of any sort?
Right, exactly. So then, you know, lots of unemployment, but lots of, you know, mental health issues, alcoholism, addictions. And then, as is often the case, right, family abandonment. So I spoke to a woman who grew up without her dad, without her First Nations dad, because he was just hounded by these monsters, right, and by this addiction, and by mental health crises. And so then you've got the second generation, right? Then there's a person who grows up without a dad, and there's thousands of people like that. Or grow up with parents in the house who are physically abusive, because this is how they learned to institute authority, right? So tons of family abuse like that. And so, you know, and then there's other sort of maybe a little softer, but the loss of language
I was going to say crimes against the culture as well. It wasn't just crimes against the individual or the family. I mean, how do you restore if you've crushed a generational passage? You know, these folks weren't able to pass on the culture to their children. Are they trying to address that problem?
Yeah, and that's a big part of these agreements that come out of the settlement, these agreements within the culture. But, you know, as somebody who's Irish and a writer, I think a lot about the loss of our language, mm-hmm. right?
There's a lot to, well, I don't want to, every tragedy like this is unique in its own way, but the Irish under the penal laws had a similar experience, and particularly the language devastation.
Yeah, I mean, like a very similar experience, right, with a very similar goal of freeing up desirable land by erasing and immiserating of people who were already there. It's like a good dry run. So as a writer, anyway, I think about what are the thoughts I would have if I had the language of my great-grandparents that was forcibly taken from us, right? What are the things I can't think about and the metaphors I can't understand because that language has been stripped? And so this was something that was happening to First Nations people in Canada in the 1960s.
Right. Now, do you have a sense that other countries are looking to Canada? Obviously, this Truth and Reconciliation Commission has been tried in other countries and other settings, but think of a place like Ireland that's going through its own reckoning right now. Other countries look to Canada as a potentially a model for how to do this?
It was really interesting to do the, for me anyway, to do the research on how these Truth and Reconciliation Commissions work, and they're all a little bit different, and yet they all work on some similar models, and so there's discussion around that in the article. People who are experts on how it's worked in South Africa, how it's worked in Rwanda, how it's worked, and what it is that we're trying to do when you have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And that might be an area of like some small hope, where there are smart people who think about this all the time and who go from case to case trying to build up how do we heal. Because the point isn't to just list the sins forever, right? Like the point isn't to say, well, that was bad and that was also bad and this was another horrible thing. The point is to try to build that healthy society and try to build that kingdom of God. And there's techniques and strategies for how we can do that that are actually not at all woo-woo, that are actually very, like, practical. And so it was good to know that there's people who think about that and are working on that.
Are there people working on that in the United States specifically?
This is a Canadian problem, Ashley. I think we've demonstrated that it was a Canadian problem. And
the thing I thought about the whole time in writing it was that I hoped people would read it as a metaphor for the U.S. Imagine if we recounted this around Native Americans in the U.S. or around African Americans in the U.S. And, you know, this process in Canada was about this residential school system. It wasn't about colonization, right? So similarly in the U.S., what if we just started in the post-World War II era, right? And what if we didn't even start with slavery or emancipation or Jim Crow? What if we just started with the GI Bill, the thing that made my family middle class, the thing that made me able to do everything that I've been able to do, the benefits that accrued to my dad because he wasn't black, right? What if we just started there? That would be an amazing thing, and it would be so hard for us, and we would spend so much time saying, but my dad worked hard, right? And that would be accurate, and also we would need to hear.
It would be accurate but not complete.
Yeah. So hopefully people will read it and be able to think not just, wow, I'm so glad the Canadians are doing this, right? But that we all have things to face and that they would be better if we could be brave enough to hear them, but that's really hard. And I think it's really hard because in this case, for the religious people, it's the thing that made this happen was the religion, right? They're not ancillary. The Canadian government was part of a Christian movement to take over that country, that piece of land. And they needed to clear it of the people who were there, and they needed to say that this religion is right and this one is bad, and we need to erase that one. And for faith-filled people and people who are proud to be Catholic, that's awful to contemplate, but it's also true.
Right. And it shows you, I mean, early in American history, there were many Catholics who felt that the church and state should be closer, should be united, but over time came to realize why it was important for them to be separate, and you start to see it in stories like this. When the church and the state in Ireland and in Canada were working together, some of these abuses could occur.
Yeah, we needed plausible deniability.
Right. Well, again, we want to thank Eileen Markey for joining us, for coming in today. And again, you can read her article at americamagazine.org. And of course, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And we invite you to subscribe to America. And you can do that by calling 1-800-627-9533. That's 1-800-627-9533. For Father Matt Malone and for Kevin Clark and Ashley McKinless, thank you and have a good week.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.